good evening, everyone. Welcome to what promises to be another fascinating and informative Lowy Institute at the NGV event. My name is Lydia Khalil. I'm a research fellow at the Lowy Institute, and I'm going to be your moderator tonight for tonight's discussion. We have a fantastic panel lined up to discuss a very timely topic, so tonight promises not to disappoint. Our conversation tonight on international relations in the online age dovetails quite nicely, I think, with the themes of the NGV triennial, which are time, movement, virtuality, and change, and the mission of the Lowy Institute, which is to research and inform on international trends shaping Australia and the world. Cyberspace and digital technology are certainly shaping international trends in transformative ways. Digital technology is disrupting the ways and means of international engagement. The past few years in particular, I think, have underscored this for me. Each passing year has clearly demonstrated the way in which the world is more interconnected, how the transmission of information and disinformation happens near instantaneously, how we face threats and vulnerabilities as well as opportunities in the online realm. The news headlines dominating this week and particularly today are about influence operations utilizing social media. And here I'm thinking particularly of Russian meddling in the US elections and the Cambridge Analytica Facebook scandal. Think about this fact. Influence operations in cyberspace arguably have made and have the potential to unmake a US president. That's pretty incredible. The openness of the internet and the free flow of information have been a major boon, but they've also been exploited on a massive scale to engender not just lack of trust and confidence in government institutions, but have challenged the very concept of truth itself. This is having enormous consequences in our society and how we relate to each other, let alone how governments regulate this space and how governments themselves operate in the space. The internet and cyber technology is vastly changing the ways in which diplomacy and government communications are being conducted. We have a president tweeting foreign policy decisions in real time. Australia and governments around the world are still grappling with how best to pursue their interest in the digital environment and using cyber tools. How will governments continue to communicate and influence in the digital realm? How are warfare and intelligence operations being conducted in cyberspace? What would that even look like? Is cyber war the war of the future? Is Australia prepared with an arsenal of offensive and defensive cyber weapons? All the while, internet and cyber tools have narrowed the gap of influence and blurred the lines of distinction between state and non-state actors. We're shifting from an almost utopian view of cyberspace and internet-enabled communications to a stark realization of the diminished promises and prospects of the open internet. There are real questions about the way forward. The concept of digital sovereignty is challenging the concept of the open internet. Countries, particularly in Asia, are erecting cyber walls and dividing up what was once this vast, frolicking meadow of the open internet. In more open societies, there's a concern that the internet is not regulated enough, especially when we rely so heavily on it, on private technology companies, for our communication and for our convenience. The key question, I guess, is can governments continue to shape the future and regulate in the digital age, assuming the same robust role they did in the analog era? Many questions. And we have an exceptional panel tonight to explore all of those questions. And I'm very excited to introduce to them now. I know they'll have a lot to say on these topics and more. And so I'm going to invite our panelists to come up as I introduce to you now. Come on up, guys. Our first panelist is Professor Jill Slay. She's a new Melburnian. You should welcome her. She was recently appointed as the inaugural La Trobe University Optus Cyber Chair, and she will lead cybersecurity teaching, research, and industry collaboration at La Trobe. Professor Slay has published a book and more than 120 book chapters, journal articles, and research papers on information assurance, critical infrastructure protection, security, and forensic computing. She's also the director of the Australia Centre for Cybersecurity at the University of New South Wales. She's a fellow at the International Information Systems Security Certification Consortium. That's a mouthful. And She's also a fellow at the Australian Computer Society and will continue to serve as the Director of Cyber Resilience Initiatives at the ACS. In 2011, she was made a member of the Order of Australia for her service to information technology industry. Next, we have Dr. Carl Ungerer. Dr. Carl Ungerer is a recognized expert in foreign policy and national security with over 25 years' experience as both a practitioner and academic in international affairs. Carl consults regularly to governments, corporations, and international organizations around the world. Most recently, he was the head of the Leadership Crisis and Conflict Management Program at the Geneva Center for Security Policy in Switzerland. And between 2012 and 13, he was the senior advisor to the Australian Foreign Minister, with responsibilities for all aspects of international policy, including responses to crises in Middle East, Asia, and the Pacific. He's designed and led multinational and multidisciplinary research teams on counterterrorism, countering violent extremism, and cybersecurity. His previous appointments include Director of National Security Program at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, a Senior Strategic Analyst at the Office of National Assessments, and a career diplomat with the Australian Department of Foreign Service. And last but not least, Danielle Cave. She's a senior analyst working at the International Cyber Policy Center, also at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. She's worked in international relations across government and non-government since 2006, and she's published and led projects on a range of global issues with focus on how cyberspace and digital technologies are impacting Australia's place in the world. She's also a PhD scholar at the Bell School of Asia Pacific Affairs at ANU, and in 2016 was a Google Policy Fellow attached to the Harvard University Incubated Digital Asia Hub in Hong Kong. She's a former analyst and team leader at the Open Source Center at the Office of National Assessments, and in 2009-12, she worked as a research associate at the Lowy Institute's Melanesia Program. Please join me in welcoming our panelists today. Oh, that's quite a mouthful to get through all of your credentials. I have to sit down for that, but it shows we're going to have a good discussion tonight. So I want to do a few opening questions before I open it up to the audience. And my first question to the panel is on influence operations. Like I said, it's been a major headline in the news today. Mark Zuckerberg is being hauled in front of Congress to explain and atone for Facebook's many sins on how user data is being exploited by the private sector and by governments for cyber influence operations. And Danielle, this is an area that you've done a lot in, so I'd like to turn to you first. Sure. You had a piece recently, I think today or yesterday, on cyber-enabled information and influence operations. Mm. Can you explain to us what a cyber-enabled influence operation is, and can you give us some examples of how they work, particularly here in our own region in Asia?
Sure. So this is, as Lydia said, this is an incredibly hot topic at the moment in Canberra. There isn't really an agreed-upon definition. There's, you know, if you're interested in this topic, I'd urge you to look up Herb Lin and Jackie Kerr have a paper out recently, and there's really not a lot that, you know, you can sort of read up in terms of the sort of modern cyber-enabled influence operation. But it's not misinformation, so it's not our parents and grandparents sending us clickbait stories over WhatsApp or over Facebook Messenger. It really is, it's disinformation. So it's the very deliberate strategic and tactical use of cyberspace against an adversary to things like manipulate, distract, or confuse a group of people or a population. So state and non-state actors can engage in this. So obviously what we saw in the US, the sort of quite sophisticated cyber-enabled influence operation deployed by Russia's intelligence service was very impressive. In our own region, we're sort of seeing little bits of this playing out in Southeast Asia particularly. Governments, for example, an Oxford report actually linked President Duterte's office to a very big bot swarm, and they had allegedly paid a couple hundred thousand US dollars to push forward the president's message and then counter what they saw as negative messages about the president. obviously in Taiwan. Taiwan's a real hotbed of cyber-enabled influence operations. There's actually a case before the courts in Taiwan at the moment which alleged that the Chinese government's Taiwan office has been running a sort of series of influence operations in Taiwan. So while they're not really in the headlines, this is really something that we're seeing starting to play out in the Asia Pacific.
So last season's of Homeland is not far-fetched.
No, it's not.
It's actually happening.
Yeah.
Jill, you've done some pioneering work on cybersecurity and have worked closely with Australian government on this issue to help bolster cybersecurity education and awareness on a lot of levels, both in law enforcement and the military. Do you think the Australian government is well-equipped to deal with any cyber influence operations headed our way?
I think
controversial question. I
think that we've probably been slow to understand that what we're experiencing are cyber influence operations. I want to be fair to either side of the government. I think what sits behind that, and this is the conversation that we were having, that we're in a domain where we have to some extent understand the technology, and to also to a greater extent understand policy issues, as well as the issues which used to live in the domain of spies, and we're trying to bring them all together into an academic or a group of academics who are then going to train other people. So if I was being critical, I would say I'm not sure where the leadership is in Canberra in these areas. But if I was being kind, I would say if you were to look at the university or the sort of TAFE system, which one of us knew that we needed to be teaching these things? Mm-hmm. I've always pointed it out with defending the critical infrastructure, which is a great burden for us, where we're looking at the control systems which sit behind, say, power stations. But I went and investigated curriculum, and neither the IT people nor the engineers were learning anything about this. And yet you've got to put those two worlds, the physical world of valves and switches and pumps, together with the internet world of TCP/IP and being able to use one to attack the other. We just haven't moved quickly enough to keep up with the threats.
So it's safe to say that there's a general lack of awareness about cybersecurity in general.
I think that there is now an understanding of awareness, personal awareness, people trying to talk about it like hygiene, and that perhaps that area is growing. But I do not think there is a deep understanding of the imminent danger from an unknown enemy in attacking our critical infrastructure. And I don't think I'm overstating. This is what I've learned, and I'm desperate to share it with other people.
Well, today's a good venue for that.
Thank you.
That's good. Carl, you've held senior positions in the Australian government in international services. So we've talked about influence operations as a threat, but there's the other side to influence operations, which is digital diplomacy and the more transparent ways that governments go about using the internet and cyberspace to influence. Can you talk about digital diplomacy as kind of a pathway to achieving foreign policy outcomes? And if you have any experiences in that and in some of the foreign policy work you've done?
Sure. Thanks, Lydia, and welcome everyone. No, it's interesting. There's John Kerry, who was the former Secretary of State in the US, said only a couple of years ago, there's no such thing as digital diplomacy. There's just diplomacy, and it uses a variety of tools. It can use digital tools, it can use face-to-face tools, a whole range of other things. But it's just a means by which governments communicate with each other and communicate messages. Sometimes those messages seek to influence other countries. Sometimes they're used as an attractive mechanism, a soft power way of attracting people to your ideas and products and institutions and maybe to your country as a tourism venue. But, you know, digital diplomacy is something that really has only come about in the last 20 years, I suppose. Before that, we used to talk about information operations, and that was just the ability to try and that goes back to the beginnings of warfare and interstate diplomacy from the time of the Treaty of Westphalia onwards. We've been using information to talk to each other and to influence each other. The digital domain what it's done, of course, it speeds that up. It creates both opportunities and vulnerabilities in the systems that we use. And it also means we do things, as you said, you know, you have a president who obviously sitting there at midnight tweeting foreign policy from the White House, which is something that we've not seen before. But, you know, I mean, this is not new. I've sat next to the foreign minister while he's been sort of messaging other foreign ministers and working out foreign policy across a large table during a major negotiation. So it's just, you know, for me, these are just tools of diplomacy. They can be useful at times. There's certainly a high threat element. I wanted to go back to Jill's point about the lack of recognition, I think you're trying to make in government circles about the nature of the threat. I'm not as clear on that because, you know, being in the foreign minister's office, you know, a couple of years ago, we gave Bob an email, a printout of an email, and we said, this has come off your personal email server. And we didn't get it from any Australian system. We stole this from somewhere else. And that brought home the reality that the nature of the type of threats that the foreign minister himself was, you know, being targeted for, you know, his personal email account. So I think there is an awareness. Governments are trying to do something about it. Have they done enough? I don't know. You know, the appointment of an ambassador for cyber affairs, Toby Feakin's job, you know, other things have made progress. But I think the audience might have some more thoughts about the nature of the threat and response.
Perhaps it doesn't fit so neatly within our bureaucratic constructs at the moment. That could be one of the...
Oh, I think that's right.
Yeah.
And if I could jump in, sure. I sort of bouncing off what Jill said before, I do wonder if a lot of the cyber threats today can't be solved by traditional cyber security, because it's actually about information and data. Mm. It's not about these traditional sort of cyber security threats. So I think that's where the gap is. There's actually a shift going on, and governments are always behind because they're not intended to be these flexible, fast-moving, fast-adaptive organisations. They're slow and more resilient. And so I think when it comes to cyber, there's always going to be that lag, that catch-up.
Mm. That's right.
So I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about terrorist organisations and their use of the internet. There's a lot in the news about how the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda have used the internet and cyber technology and digital communications for promulgating propaganda. But I think what's little discussed is the innovative ways they've used the internet and cyber tools to actually conduct operations and the government's cyber response to them. And whether there's this big question about have we been successful in responding, or like Danielle mentioned earlier, they're a step ahead of many governments in this space. Carl, I'll come back to you on this since you've done some work researching with terrorist organizations. What are your thoughts on this?
It's really interesting. We did some work going back 5 or 6 years now about terrorist use of the internet, and what we found there's about 5,000 now websites that are directly related to terrorist organizations around the world, and they're changing very quickly. So back in sort of the beginning part of the decade, in around 2010, terrorist websites were very rudimentary things. They were just simply showing pictures or newspaper clippings of other organizations or stories that they might put up there. But they very rapidly shifted over a period of 3 or 4 years to in a number of ways, one in which was that they started to have their own media capabilities. That is, they were able to have so-called reporters on the ground filming particular actions and reporting as if that they were just an independent news media organisation with a kind of independent and non-biased view of the action, when in fact they were extraordinarily biased. So there's that aspect of it that was interesting. There was the aspect of, you know, the focus of many of these websites had really come down to focusing on 6 to 8-year-olds. So there were gamification elements to the websites. They were trying to attract very young children through ideas about gaming and gamification into the material that they were then presenting them on these websites. And of course, thirdly, you know, it's not just been this tool of propaganda. I mean, we've seen a lot of that. But it's, you know, they actively use digital platforms for recruitment, for messaging, and for actual operations. And each time governments sort of, catch up to them and start to sort of monitor and see what they're doing. They'd migrate from, first it was around Twitter, and they'd have, you know, ISIS had 40,000 Twitter accounts at one stage. They'd migrate quickly from that to Telegraph, then to Kik, and then to wherever they're going to go next, because they quickly know that once they're being monitored, they have to shift. And their ability to do that, to migrate very quickly across different platforms and new applications, confounds the intelligence and security agencies, because we simply can't keep up with the pace of agility that they have.
Mm. What about you, Jill? You have done a lot of work in the criminal space,
yeah,
about criminal organizations and how they use and exploit cyberspace and cyber tools. Can you give us a glimpse into that work that you've done and some of the operations that have been conducted?
So if I'm just going to assume that there are some non-technical people in the room. So most of us, if we used our normal browser and we did a search on Google, would not be able to find much criminal activity. But if we go to the darknet and we use a sort of a browser like Tor, which is an anonymizer, so nobody can trace us, we enter the realm of cybercrime as a service. I've been looking at this since about 2007 with one of the, oh, we've had a series of grants from law enforcement, but we looked at internet-mediated drug crime and worked with the government on just trying to understand for ourselves in what are now the old days of 2007, what was going on. But some of the things that have really amused me, I've got a strange sense of humour, but it's the sort of cybercrime as a service through the darknet in the cloud, because I was trying to do some research with a postdoc on, you know, what would digital forensics in the cloud look like? What is the research agenda? But we can actually buy an attack as a package in the cloud. We can decide whether it's going to be an easy company to attack through their website or more difficult company, and we're talking about tens of dollars. But we can also have a 24-hour online support and tutorials in designing the attack. So,
wow.
What was difficult in 2007 is almost trivialized. It was almost trivialized in 2016 when we published that kind of paper. So we have to assume that those resources are out there for anyone who has just got access to the Tor browser, which is very, very easy to get. And so that's been put there as a kind of protection. I think the difficulties for us is just the exponential growth and also the just the intelligence, the sheer intelligence of the criminals who... So criminals stroke terrorists, because once you start searching these things, so we have sort of we have people with ideology hiring people who have the skills who are just criminal who will serve any kind of ideology. So we hire the best criminal. We have kinds of consortia of terrorist plus criminal to design the attacks that we might have on the infrastructure. And there are some people who, when we're thinking about information operations against us, I'm sure if we went out there onto the darknet, that we would find those who are willing to construct exactly what we want for us.
Mm.
So that's my experience of what's out there.
Mm. That's an incredible prospect.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Going back a bit more broadly, I want to explore a bit the tensions between openness and secrecy in the digital realm and in the physical realm as well. I want to explore a bit about the benefits and drawbacks of the open internet. Governments have kind of needed some level of secrecy and confidentiality in order to conduct their business, right? That's how they pursue their national interests, formulate policies, conduct negotiations. However, it's being challenged by this open environment in the internet, you know, with WikiLeaks being the private prime example, and others kind of pushing for this notion that nothing should be secret, nothing should be confidential. On the other hand, the open internet has exposed corruption and scandals that would normally be hidden by public interest, so that's been a good. And cyberspace has become this kind of ecosystem for communication and assembly in countries, perhaps more authoritarian countries, that don't have that available for citizens in the physical space. So have democratic governments and those that promote an open internet that are being challenged by this openness and authoritarian governments seeking to create cyber borders, but there's still seepage. Danielle, I want to go to you on this topic. You've done a lot of work looking at cyber borders and cyber sovereignty, particularly in Asia, and China's leveraging of cyberspace. You've also labeled Asia as the digital center of gravity on this issue. Can you explain that notion of cyber sovereignty and how it clashes with this idea of the open internet?
Sure. So I'll start with the digital center of gravity. So that's an argument I've made in a couple papers now that when we look at, I guess, the global cyberspace, what I think is the most sort of dynamic sphere is what's going on in Asia. So North Asia is producing, most of the world's new large tech companies now and social media networks. It houses about 1.6 billion social media users, which is more than, I think, the rest, every other region stitched together. All the new smartphone editions are coming out of India, China, Myanmar, Indonesia. So you have this sort of enormous, exciting growth ecosystem. But at the same time, you have this really, I think, quite speedy shift towards cyber censorship and the use of quite sophisticated tools to enable that censorship, and then also towards really strict information controls. So the Freedom of the Net Index does a great index every year on this. And you know, it's really worrying because if we think about our region in the Asia Pacific, besides maybe New Zealand, Japan, Taiwan, not so much the Philippines, every other country is moving towards really strict censorship and it's getting worse and worse and worse. Now, obviously, China is the leader in that space. They have the Great Firewall. They control what comes in and what goes out. Vietnam is sort of really, you know, pushing hard on the information control sphere. And I think a lot of these countries are looking at China now because, you know, at the same time that we have this happening, we have Mark Zuckerberg and the disaster that has been Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. And it's almost given, I think, people who want to push this censorship bent a bit of space to say, look, actually, we control our information sphere and we don't have all those problems that are going on in the US and in democracies all around the world. So I actually think it's a little bit of a terrifying time because for once you can, you know, we and through Australia's new cyber ambassador pushes an open and free cyberspace, and I think we should always continue to do that. We should have an open and free cyberspace, but we're one of the few countries that do, and I actually think the trend is going in the opposite direction and it's not good for us in Australia.
Mm. Carl, what about you? Do you think that Australia should always promote the open internet? Is it in Australia's national interest still, given all the problems that we have with exploitation?
Oh, absolutely it is. I mean, as a medium-sized country that relies on trade for its prosperity, and as more and more of international commerce migrates online, having a free and open internet is absolutely essential to Australia. But it's interesting, as Danielle says, you know, the centerpiece of the Australian government's new cyber strategy is sort of to promote and to have as its, you know, pillar the promotion of a free and open internet architecture. But increasingly, very few countries agree with that. I mean, we used to have the United States as one of the principal allies in that debate, and I'm not sure, I agree with you, I'm not sure that the current administration in the US shares that sort of news. You only have to listen to Trump on fake news and, you know, he's always lambasting the Washington Post or others, because he doesn't like Jeff Bezos or whatever it is. But, you know, I don't think we've got an ally in the Americans in this particular fight at the moment. And the change, as Danielle says, is not going in our direction. But it is really important because without it, you know, we're not going to be able to interact with the world in the ways we would like.
Jill, I'd like to get your thoughts kind of on the perils of the open internet and the lack of cybersecurity awareness on a topic that you've talked passionately about, which is this issue of intellectual property theft.
Yeah.
And what's been happening in that realm. Can you tell us a bit about that and particularly how China has been kind of notorious intellectual property thief and how it's impacted Australia's foreign policy interests and national security interests?
I guess when I listen to others talk about it, I want a free and open internet at the information level, but I don't know that we can have a free and open internet at the technical level, and I question some of the things that we do as corporations or governments, because we tend to want to network and share every single piece of data or information that we've ever created, and we don't have the common sense to decide which of it should be online and which of it shouldn't, because we create huge problems for ourselves because we're sharing on an infrastructure which basically was never designed to be secured. And I think lots of the work that we've done since is to secure something which was never meant to be secure. So that's probably what are the underpinnings for me of what we do. I think that there are cases which are well known of what's happened between China and America. And I think about the development of Huawei and its routers and having the claims of Cisco, which I believe were taken to court, where Cisco could prove that the coding which was in the routers still had the comments and the flaws which Cisco had produced when they were producing the original code. So they could actually prove that their intellectual property had been stolen. And there are other cases where others can show rapid Chinese development of warplanes where which look very, very similar to those from other Western countries. There's also the recent book by Clive Hamilton, which actually names and shames quite a few people who and brings this whole argument to the front. I think it's an area where those of us who work in cybersecurity as academics, and there are not so many of us around who've been around a long time. But when I was still a senior lecturer and I was wanting to work with law enforcement, I was advised by the older people around is that you must be really wary about what you're sharing with any kind of international student. It wasn't China, it was any country. Because essentially, we are the powerhouse of the intellectual property for our country, and so thus it was: do not teach beyond up to master's coursework level beyond what's in the textbook. And I've kept that with me because I actually do see the national security implications. Because if we look at ourselves as a country, we're either going to be dependent on American defense contractors or maybe French contractors to develop cybersecurity technology, or we're going to do some of it for ourselves. And if we're going to do some of it for ourselves from an intellectual property point of view, just because we want to grow business, and also because of the national security issue, we've got to keep some of our national security. So you find yourself in the position where you are not free enough to act like other academics who want to share everything that you're producing, because you're always thinking about how does this benefit or not benefit Australia if I share this. So I've had over the years, and I lived in Asia for 10 years, and I've had lots of dealings with China and other Asian countries. I've had colleagues in those countries who do exactly the same research as me. We're going down the same research path, doing the same kind of work in digital forensics, and it would be lovely to work with them. But we're now at the stage where it's not just a hesitation from me, but it's a hesitation from the other side, because we're all being taught to protect our intellectual property from the other. So it's not one way. It's not one way anymore. But I would have to say that it's very uncomfortable. It doesn't fit with our normal academic paradigm. And I'm not convinced that I've ever really been given guidance on what I should be doing. I just make the rules up as I go. And I think it's something that we need to come to terms with nationally.
Yeah, it's a really interesting dynamic. You know, that's one of the prices of kind of being at the pioneering end of a cutting edge issue, and with major national security implications.
Yeah.
I want to ask one last question before I open it up to the audience. I want to make sure I leave a bit of time for the audience to ask the questions. We've talked about how the current digital environment is shaping the current dynamic in terms of how governments operate in the digital realm and how international relations is being conducted. But I'd like to talk about what you think is going to come next. Things like artificial intelligence or automation. What are your predictions about how these future innovations in the digital realm are going to affect society and how we interact in the world? Danielle, I'll go to you with this one if you had any thoughts on it first.
Sure. So I think what I worry about now, and I've actually commissioned a paper on this that should come out in a couple months, is looking at some of the mammoth investments occurring in our region in the artificial intelligence space. Obviously, most of those are coming from China. They are very savvy in this space. They are throwing huge amounts of money. And one particular thing is sort of tweaked my interest, and that is their development of a national social credit system. So, which is very sort of has a sort of very, I guess, AI underbelly underneath it, and that will roll out in 2020, and that will rank citizens on a variety of measures. And there's already city level and community level and province level pilots going on, and communities can come up with their own pilots based on the official pilots. So I'm quite worried about the regional implications of that. So what does that mean for Chinese Australians here in Australia? Will they still be ranked while they're here? How will that change regional behaviour? Will a country like Vietnam pick up on that? I wouldn't be surprised. And how will that sort of roll out in Southeast Asia? So that's what I'm terrified about at the moment.
And so these rankings, they're going to affect their ability to access services or government assistance?
Yeah, thank you for prompting me to explain it better. So essentially what it looks like at the moment is that you get a ranking and you are penalised for bad behaviour. So bad behaviour at the moment seems to mostly be breaking the law. So a parking fine, you will lose, say, 5 points. Jaywalking, you will lose points. If an organisation says that you were difficult to deal with, there's a whole sort of range.
And I would have an abysmal ranking.
I'm always fines. Behind on paying parking fines. Yeah. I will end up with 0 points. Yeah. And it's because I move all the time and I just can't keep on top of my admin. Maybe that's why it terrifies me, because if it ever sort of comes down here, I'm in big trouble.
Yeah, but in trouble.
And it's that, and the problem is that communities are then making their own versions of it. So one version I've looked into is that a community of 5,000 people will penalise you if you talk about religious issues online. So I think that's where it gets tricky. You know, jaywalking and parking tickets, fine. But once you then sort of move into this this other space, that's a big worry. So if you drop down in rankings, you can't travel internationally, buy a plane ticket, buy a rent a car, you can't get a loan. On the other hand, if you're doing really well, you get favourable loan conditions. I saw something like $50 a year off your heating bill, which is sort of a niche thing to be rewarded about, but a whole range of positives. Mm. So, and it's exactly like that Black Mirror episode. I don't know if anyone's seen it. Where the woman gets ranked and she just then just trying to rent a car and something happens and it's just like a disaster. Mm. There are similarities, and I think that's a real worry for Asia. Mm. And I do think it will end up affecting us here in Australia. Mm.
Carl, what about you? Any future trends that you either worry about or welcome?
No, it's all worry in this business. There's very little welcome. For me, it's around, you know, the changing nature of warfare and the use of offensive cyber weapons and how that's going to proceed. We've had the Australian government come out very recently and say that it is developing offensive cyber capabilities, and they're not the first government to say that. Indeed, we're sort of 8 years since the Stuxnet virus that started to spin the centrifuges at Natanz in Iran a little bit fast, and the Iranians couldn't work out why that was the case. But that was a virus introduced into Siemens operating systems to stop the further enrichment of uranium by the Iranians. So, you know, and then you look at things that are going on with Russia, and it's sort of hybridized warfare, denial of service attacks that they've made against Estonia and Georgia and others. I think we're moving into a kind of normalized way where warfare will be conducted simultaneously by physical means and by online means, and how that progresses is I think a really interesting question for me. The Chinese talk about their strategy being sort of localized warfare in an informationized environment, whatever that means. But clearly it means that they are preparing for some sort of this hybrid warfare of both online attacks as simultaneously with physical attacks. And I just, I think that is going to, we've not seen the end of this.
So do you think these offensive cyber capabilities a la Stuxnet and even maybe even beyond that have kind of become the new nuclear weapons, something that all, you know, countries have but are too afraid to use lest they kind of unleash other offensive capabilities against them? Or is it, like you said, kind of moving to this cyber hybrid space where you can get away with using a little bit of it without going full-on nuclear?
Yeah, I mean, to date, the sort of introduction of viruses like this has been a fairly, you know, rapier-like instrument of warfare, even though shutting down the Siemens operating systems in the Natanz uranium enrichment facility actually hurt Indonesia more than anywhere else because it was the country that was running more Siemens operating systems than anywhere else. But so it had, you know, a widespread effect, but really people saw it for exactly what it was. It was a deliberate effort to try and thwart the Iranian nuclear program. Look, you know, I don't think you equate yet offensive cyber warfare capabilities with weapons of mass destruction. It doesn't have the mass effect, it just simply doesn't yet. But, you know, I think it's a case of watch this space a little bit.
Jill, what about you? Any predictions?
I think I would probably just tend to disagree with that because it's having researched a lot in this area, I just think it was accidental that Stuxnet didn't do more damage than it did at the time. I've taught a master's course on cyber terrorism and went through and analysed the code. There's some, I can't remember, it was Semantic or somebody had already done that. So there was actually some quite elegant coding in there. But the way I have it in my head is that because I believe there are at least 40 countries, I might be wrong, you policy people, who've declared that they've got offensive cyber capacity. So there's 40 times the brain power at least working on issues. And I have the feeling that perhaps people, there are lots of people developing cyber weapons. The fear that for me that is behind this is, as the technologist, is actually the engine which drives it is the same engine which drives cybercrime. So it's not as if we can compartmentalize war, terrorism and crime. To me, they're very often the same thing because I just go to see what is the system, what is the software, what are they doing, what kind of technology is it, and what future technology might they use to do the same thing. And so it's quite frightening when because the cybercrime aspects are actually usually more visible to us because they're not so, sort of secured. And so if we look at what cyber criminals could do, I think that can be used against us. But to answer the original question, I think that I've got involved in machine learning. So for me, as a professor of digital forensics, I started with the AFP when we were always trying to have standard operating procedures for mobile phones, you know. And when I started about 2003, there we had all these different cables with different connectors, but there were so few phones around, we could actually keep up with the development of the phone. But we got to be about 2007 when we had to, you know, at crime scenes and bombs and things where you had so many devices. You had to think, let me suck it all in and let me sort of do all the magic on it and let me visualize the data and the social networks. So the forensics of the phones was then who could possibly own this phone and which one of these people can I prove who's the terrorist without knowing who they really are. But now I'd been overseas for a couple of years and came back and realised that I was in the big data age and I'd have to come to terms with the desire for people. They wanted me to help develop intrusion detection systems and real-time forensic systems using big data and machine learning. And I thought I couldn't do it because I didn't want to go back and relearn my maths. But I got off some fantastic PhD students who have much better maths than me from Egypt. Egyptian maths is better than mine. And I'm overwhelmed by the fact that we apparently can make really efficient intrusion detection systems. But I want to, even as I'm saying this is good and we're publishing it and people saying this is great, I want to question it, and because it's just some mathematics applied to some data to produce something which we're actually going to want to be really trustworthy. So it's the testing of the product after we've done the algorithmic part is what is worrying me. And I think it's the same problem as the flaws in those autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars. So I want somebody to be aware that the maths was great, but please test the system once we've produced it. So there are philosophers who want to act on the same kinds of things that I'm doing, but I actually want the technical people to examine it before we let philosophy loose on what we're actually producing here, if you don't mind. Just in case you are philosophers as well.
I'm not.
Well, I think this is a great point to open it up to audience questions. We have time, I think, for a few. So if anyone in the audience wants to bring any topic up to the panel.
Thank you for the address today. We have a nurse in Australia. We have educated a nurse in Australia and a medical practitioner in Australia, and they both went to join Islamic State in the Middle East. Israel and the US are 1 year away from war with Iran. You talk about the dark web. To what extent have we educated criminals and terrorists in Australia, and to what extent have we promoted them through to senior roles within government and private organisations within Australia?
Well, I think that's probably a particular question, a very specific question that many of the panelists probably can't pinpoint their fingers on. But what about this idea of how people from a completely different country can connect with terrorist organizations on the other side of the world, or with people anywhere using these kind of digital technologies? What about this idea? Anyone on the panel have any comment on that and how it's enabled it, how governments can respond to this?
I can begin to answer that and the question, actually. So I can't guarantee that I haven't trained terrorists or criminals. I've taught more than 1,000 students in Hong Kong at the Baptist University. I've worked with the Malaysian government, and I have a couple of PhD students who work for the Malaysian government. But I'm very aware of what they all learned and what I taught them and what they researched and what we published together. And I would see that as an issue for myself, my own ethics of what I personally have been able to do. But given that we all have our own personal freedom, and given that when somebody's interested in these topics, they're going to go and learn a lot for themselves. All I can do as an academic is to actually help them to apply that knowledge. I would be very concerned if they've gone and done something illegal, criminal, or something which didn't fit with my belief system. But I don't think I can actually truly control them beyond what my contribution is to that. That's probably the best way I can engage with the question.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think very quickly, you know, when I was in the minister's office, there was, you know, clearly a few cases came before us for visa applications for students to come to Australia to study things. And in each of those visa applications, there's a fairly rigorous and methodical process to look at their background and who they are and what they might be doing with the information that they might get as a result of being a student in Australia. And there were plenty, I can't say exactly how many, but there were plenty of cases where student visas were rejected on the grounds that we would not want that student studying that subject in this country.
Thank you. Very interesting discussion. I'm thinking back 50 years ago in the anti-war movement and looking back through old ASIO files about the technology used to collect information from potential threats to the state. And it was quite extensive in those days in the technology used, wiretapping and everything else. The question that comes to my mind now with this incredibly changing technology, is it possible for Australia to strengthen its defences of infrastructure that's related to the internet, to create a common attitude towards resilience in dealing with in all sorts of threats that our regional, that the region will produce in the next few years, and also to have an open democracy? Is it possible to maintain that, given the technology that's available?
I might take one more question in the back as well, and we can answer the questions together.
We've talked a lot about the weaknesses and the threats of the online age as it relates to international relations. What are some of the positives that the online age and a improved communication method can deliver us?
Question. There must be some good to come out of this. Uber Eats is one of them, at least. Jill, what about this question of resiliency and critical infrastructure?
So I think you're asking, can we have a resilient infrastructure and the sort of intellectual freedom that we're asking for? So I have been involved with whatever government department has owned the topic of resilience since about 2003. And so we used to have the Department of Broadband and Communications and the Digital Economy. I only go back that far. I wasn't in Australia even in the times you were thinking of. And it's moved to AGs and things. And so I think that we haven't always engaged fully with the issue of creating the resilient infrastructure. And for me, as an engineer, I just live it and say I think it's just politicians and power play. Because if we had invested more money, we could have done some of the things that I've seen happen in the US in strengthening the infrastructure, in regulation for different sectors, in developing. They've got, you know, some great labs like Sandia Lab and Idaho National Lab, where they do really good research in those areas, which actually can increase our resilience if we choose to do that. And also, our first attack on the national critical infrastructure was deemed to be the Marucci Shire Water incident of 2001, where an insider with the passwords, because he wanted a job there, he would sort of attack the water system, and the highlight of it was sewage flowing in the streets of Noosa, and he did it for 6 months. But what needed to be protected was actually quite a trivial thing. So the cybersecurity issue underpinning it was very easy, but the American government reacted to that and put in lots of measures to strengthen the resilience in the US. And we have waited about another 16 years to do something about our critical infrastructure. So when I came back from the US all excited and said, look, we can do A, B, and C, they say, Jill, you don't understand Australia. We persuade people. We don't actually regulate, legislate. And so I just stopped because I thought, oh, well, I'm probably not a real Australian. because I think there are technical means that we have at our disposal to make this country more robust, more secure. And I think that we can do that without losing our freedom. So a lot of the work that I've done with my PhD students has been this cross-disciplinary work where I try and understand the technology, understand the legislation, and deal with the gap, because sometimes one is ahead of the other. Mm. So I think the answer to your question is yes, we could do it, and it would take a lot of money.
So Danielle, what about you? Any positives that you've seen working in this space?
Yeah, I might just jump sort of after what Jill said on the cybersecurity resilience. I think people,
yeah,
we don't focus enough on people. I'm really surprised the government, I feel like one of the lowest hanging fruit for the government in this space is a sort of cyber slip, slop, slap. And I thought that 5 years ago, and every year I think, you know, we're going to get a new minister who's going to finally get $5 or $10 million and just knock this out of the park. But I just can't believe that we don't have more sort of wider public awareness on what is a very basic issue, because most of the problems are about people.
Yeah.
So that was one thing. On the positive side of things, so I will say, I think one good thing, I don't think Australia is very good at it, but I think digital diplomacy has brought a lot of good things for a lot of smaller countries who can now actually punch above their weight because they've empowered their diplomats to go out there and cut through ridiculously bureaucratic organisations and engage in a really fast and creative way. We haven't really invested in that. I mean, our Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade gets cut year by year, like our foreign aid budget, and our intelligence community is quite small, so we don't really invest in the international aspects, I think, of our public service. So if we're not going to invest, then we're not going to be very good at digital diplomacy. But I do think globally it's been a really positive development. And finally, even though I can't stand to watch Trump tweet in the way that he does, actually getting that out there and having that public discussion about this sort of big global digital diplomacy push, getting our leaders online and getting them actually speaking to the public in a way that we can actually engage with them, I think is a fantastic thing.
Mm. I think it was the Swedish government, wasn't it, a couple of years ago where they had this talk to a Swede online or through Twitter, things like that. So are those that type of examples that you're talking about, digital diplomacy?
Yeah, they rotate their Twitter account through like a different person every week or so. I'm not sure if they're still doing it. But like Estonia is really good in this space. There's some really interesting things happening in Europe. I'm not sure that they're hugely widely read, but a lot of departments have blogs, which at least gets their views out there, which means that journalists can pick up interesting things. And, you know, I don't think that those blogs are getting thousands of hits, but I still think it's worth being more transparent and getting information out there, because foreign affairs departments are by their very nature so closed doors and so hierarchical and bureaucratic. But really, we need to hear from them. You know, we want to know what Australia is doing overseas and not just the cuddly koalas. We want to know what our policies are towards different countries in terms of trade, security, all kinds of things. So I think getting them online, even though my boss, Fergus Hansen, and I have been ranting on about this, it feels like forever now, but getting some of them online, you don't have to have the flashiest Facebook account, but just so that Australians in Hong Kong know that they can follow the page and they know what Australia is doing, because actually they're doing quite a lot. They just never really told us before. So I do think that's a positive.
So transparency, communication.
And accountability. I mean, you know, if something, you know, if we don't like something, we can then jump onto those sites and talk about it. The media can report on it. They get that feedback. Mm. That's terrifying for them, but at least they now have a bit of a feedback loop with the public.
And we now have a foreign minister that uses emoji diplomacy.
Yeah.
Which, you know, which I say a bit frivolously, because, you know, I think some of this is fluff. And just not at the core of what foreign policy or diplomacy is all about, which necessarily by its nature, as you said before, Lydia, has to be conducted at some level of confidentiality in order to work. Mm. So there's a real tension there between wanting to get more material out into the public domain. That's great. We can do all of that. Foreign ministries don't treat it seriously because it's not the serious work of diplomacy. But the one case, I think the gentleman asked the question, how has, you know, things improved? I think it's really in the consular space that things have really improved. So, you know, consular cases, Australia deals with tens of thousands of consular cases around the world every year. The use of online tools has meant we do that faster. We get to people more quickly. We can talk to their families. They can interact, you know, in the event of some sort of crisis around the world. And I think that, in particular, the consular aspect of what we do has been greatly enabled by digital means.
Well, I'm so glad to be ending this discussion on a positive note in what was a very fraught topic. So just please join me in thanking our fantastic panelists tonight. And thank you for coming. We look forward to seeing you again at another Lowy Institute NGV event as part of the triennial series. There's many, many events happening, so be sure to look on the website for more events happening in Melbourne. Thank you.